I'm Graham from Oxford, England.
I'm David from New York.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the show is Daryl Hall. He's, of course, half of the legendary chart-busting duo Hall & Oates. He sang lead and wrote or co-wrote six number one hits with the band and had a really astonishing string of chart successes. Beginning in the late 1970s and running through the mid-1980s. Now he's decided to bring the concerts to his house with a series called Live from Daryl's House that features musical collaborations with artists as diverse as Smokey Robinson and Todd Rundgren. It runs live and streaming on the web. Daryl, welcome to The Sound of Young America. It's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I had never heard your early work, and when I say your early work, I'm talking about your very, very early work until I started preparing for this interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to play this song called Girl, I Love You that you recorded.
That's early work, all right.
Yeah, that you recorded with your band.
I was 17.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
All right.
You were 17 when you recorded that song. It's a very assured production for being a 17-year-old. You co-wrote it too, right?
Yeah. Well, I basically did write it. I mean, somebody got their name on it. Not atypical in the music business, but that was my song. And well, the reason it sounds professional is because it was the backup people were Gamble and Huff. So I don't think you get more professional than that. This was in the beginning of their career as well as mine. They're a few years older than me, but we were all starting together in Philadelphia, and I think you can hear that Philly sound in there. I mean, that's a quintessential early Philly record.
Your really early band had this great band name that it was like totally the band name that you name your band when you're 17, which was the
exactly.
Temptones.
yep. Perfect name. It was, you know, everybody thought it was because of the Temptations, which it sort of was, but our play on the whole thing was we were all freshmen at Temple University.
Oh, sure.
So that's where it came from.
So the picture that I imagine when I was imagining your early days in Philadelphia, I have to admit, is heavily influenced by the Frank Stallone scenes in Rocky.
Oh, yeah.
was it really like that? Were you really, you know, singing on street corners with the stylistics?
Absolutely. You know that beginning in Rocky when they're all standing around and singing that song, Take Me Back, Won't You Take Me? You know, in the original Rocky movie?
Sure.
Well, that is real. I mean, when I say real, that was Frank singing, by the way, and some of his friends. That's the way we started. It wasn't necessarily around a burning oil can, but it was standing on corners in front of delis and, you know, hanging out literally on the street. And it was sort of a roving thing where the best singers in various neighborhoods would get together, and there was a lot of sort of doo-wop competition kind of thing going on, and it was a really interesting scene, sort of like the early rap days, only using music, street corner music, and that's really how I got started in the Philly scene. Now I was a musician before that. You know, my mother was a musician. She was in a band, and I was classically trained. And I've been a musician since I was 4 years old. But as far as the real Philly scene thing goes, that was very Rocky-like.
That song we heard was released in the mid '60s. You continue to work in the music industry in Philadelphia between the mid-60s and the early 1970s when you started to record with John Oates.
Right.
What kind of work were you doing?
I was doing songwriting and session work and doing a lot, sort of a catch-all thing. I was loosely associated with TSOP, which was the house band at Sigma Sound, which made all those Philly records. And I was on what I'd call the B team. And if they needed an extra keyboard player, a background singer, they would call me up. But I was just sort of a hanger-outer in that scene. Again, I was just a kid, and I was still going to school. So, but I was around it, you know. I was in the midst of it, and I, you know, I worked with the Stylistics and the Delphonics and 3 Degrees and Jerry Butler and all these people. You know, I was just there for it all.
Were there any particular records that you had a B team role in that were really exciting? Like, was there a song that you played a keyboard part on or sang a backup vocal on that became a hit?
I played on a record by a group called the Electric Indian, and it made the top of the charts. I don't know if it was number one in the Billboard charts, but it was way up there. It was called Kemosabe, and it's one of the stupidest records you ever heard in your life.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Electric Indian and Kemosabe. Okay, so now that we've heard that dumb record, did you really meet John Oates in the aftermath of a gang fight?
That's absolutely true. We've told that story a million times, and it's really what happened. I mean, my Temptones had that record, "Girl, I Love You," out, and John had a song called "I Need Your Love," which is also on the box set. I think that's where you found this stuff. And he had a band with his sister and with some other people called the Masters. And we both had these 45s out, and we were part of a sort of a record hop, whatever you want to call it, where people would go and lip sync their records. A fight broke out, and the show got, you know, chaos ensued, and everybody was sort of beating it out the doors, it was on a second floor, and John and I both jumped on the same elevator at the same time, rather, and that was how I found out that he was also a student at Temple, and it all sort of went from there as a friendship blossomed.
His roots were a little bit different than yours. I mean, when he makes a Back to His Roots album, it's a little folkier.
Yeah.
Than what you were doing. What did you like about this work that he was doing musically when you guys first started playing together and being friends?
Well, I found it interesting that he was such a folky and knew all these things, because there was a very vibrant folk scene, as well as an R&B scene in Philadelphia. And I didn't know very much about it because I was so much in the other side. And being a student, students are always interested in, you know, it's part of the learning process. And he had all these bluegrass songs and Bob Dylan and things like that, who I actually never listened to. And but especially the really raw stuff, the old-timey bluegrass music and things like that, that it really interested me because it's its own kind of soul. And so he, when we became friends, we started sharing apartments because we were both students in downtown Philly. And we would play these records, and I'd got a mandolin somewhere, and I tried to play that kind of stuff. And we would sit around on the front porch and stoop and try and play these Jim and Jesse songs and things like that, Bill Monroe and all that. And it was a real departure from me. But that's really, he has his a big part of him in that world. And I won't say we diverge, because we don't, because he sort of dragged me into it. And I think there are elements of that music that have entered into my songwriting style. And I still love bluegrass music and all that kind of thing.
As all of this stuff was going on at the end of the 1960s, There were huge changes going on in race relations in America that really affected also the music world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with things like the Martin Luther King assassination, all of a sudden, all of these black artists who had been making, you know, traditional Motown records, you know, what you might call pop, you know, the Sound of Young America records, started making more race conscious and culturally conscious music, started to be more independent, and soul music became, you know, took a turn for the, you know, for the blacks. It became self-consciously black music. How did that affect the two of you guys making these R&B records and being white guys?
It affected people's perception of us in after that time, and that sort of it coincided with when John and I first started recording together in the early 70s. And you're absolutely right. There was the difference between the 60s and the 70s as far as the schism that happened, this thing that this line that was drawn in the sand was very distinct. Mostly from radio standpoint and critical standpoint and the outside, what musicians call the outside, and it made it that much harder for us to get started in doing what we were doing, which was a very American kind of hybrid of European and African elements, and we had our own brand new version of that, you know. I mean, we weren't the first people ever to do anything like that, but we were certainly the first people ever to do it our way. And I think we influenced music profoundly because of it. But it was tough going, and all through the 70s, it sort of put us left footed. You know, we didn't know how to get what we were all about across to people, and there was a lot of misconception, and you know, people throwing out these ridiculous blue eyed soul things and all that kind of nonsense. It was sort of disconcerting and ultimately depressing, but I think we finally come out of that in modern times, and I think that also has a lot to our resurgence and the fact that we're on a whole new generation's radar has a lot to do with the fact that we are on we're on the post side of that.
You had recorded quite a bit as Hall & Oates before you had a real smash hit in the 70s. You started recording with the very sort of at the very beginning of the 70s, and your first real smash was Sarah Smile. You recorded a song on the previous album, which was re-released after Sarah Smile became a hit, that I really like, that I want to play a little bit of. It's called She's Gone from 1974.
Sorry, Charlie, for the imposition. I think I got the strength to carry on. Yeah, I need a drink and a quick decision. Now it's up to me. Who will be here? She's gone.
She's gone.
Oh, I better learn how to face it.
She's gone,
and she's gone. Oh, what went wrong?
What was it like to be recording these records and having? I mean, you were charting, but nothing was really getting traction. Did you feel like you were trying to figure out what you were and trying to figure out what people liked about what you were doing?
Yeah. I think we spent a long time trying to figure out how to put ourselves across to the world in a coherent way. I'm not even sure we managed to pull it off all through the 70s, really. In the 70s, there wasn't as much pressure by record companies or by the world to have hit records. Artists had a lot more room to grow. You know, what they called underground radio in those days, FM radio, was we were fine on that. You know, we got a lot of airplay. She's Gone was played. And even though we didn't have, quote, chart success, we were out there working. We had a very strong career at that point. You know, we were we were making money and we were out there constantly touring.
I want to play. I want to play one of your really huge hits from late in the 1970s, "Rich Girl." And I want to play it. I want to start at the very beginning because I think the intro is just so tasty. So let's hear "Rich Girl" from Hall & Oates, 1977, featuring the lead vocals of my guest, Daryl Hall.
You're a rich girl, and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a stiff girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far.
So something that I started wondering, Daryl, when I was looking back at your discography was there were so many R&B singers who, and especially the sort of the sweeter ones that went into the 1970s, saw the disco explosion, started recording disco records, sort of fell behind the curve and got eaten by 1981 and 1982 and, you know, F disco and the whole anti-disco backlash.
Yeah.
What was your, I mean, that was such a huge cultural force over like only a few years. What was your relationship to that huge change in the music industry?
It was a very strange time. The late 70s, like around 76, well, about 77, was all the things we're talking about, this schism between what people perceived as that, reached its apex with the whole punk thing and the whole rock crit thing that followed and actually created the punk scene, and then you had disco on the other side, and it left people. It left a lot of people very, very confused in the music business, not knowing what to do. John and I were, you know, we weren't disco artists. We weren't. Obviously, we weren't punk artists, but in my open brain, I embrace both styles. I like all kinds of cool music, and I think if you listen to our records, then you'll hear elements of both those styles in some of my songs and John's songs. But it was a very, very tough time, you know, and I think it didn't really resolve itself to any degree until about 1980, 81, something like that.
In 1981, around then, is when you started to have this sort of golden string of giant smash hits.
Yeah.
And I wonder if how the preceding 10 years of recording as Hall & Oates prepared you for the craziness of being, you know, super hit makers rather than working musicians with records on the radio.
Yeah, it was it. Our whole career has prepared us for that. Our whole lives, you know. As I said before, I started singing in front of people when I was about 4 years old. John was only about seven, you know. So we were child. We were used to being in front of audiences, and we were used to being in the studio and being recording artists. So all these things and all the ups and downs and the disco versus punk and the ups and downs of people's critical perception of us, it all prepared us for this magnifying glass being on us between 80 and 85 that we were capable of dealing with it without losing our minds. Yeah.
De La Soul, one of my favorite hip-hop groups, released this album in 1989 that featured the song Say No Go that sampled one of your vocal hooks from that record.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really epical, that De La Soul album, 3 Feet High and Rising, is a really huge record in the history of hip hop, in part because it sampled so broadly, and the effects on sampling in hip hop were sort of catastrophic, because they ended up getting sued by the Turtles, one of whose songs they had sampled, and it sort of changed the face of sampling in hip hop. When you first heard that song in 1989, first of all, how did you hear it, and what did you think about the whole situation?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was doing a video for a movie called Earth Girls Are Easy, and John and I had the closing, what they roll the credits over. They gave us the closing song. We cut some a version of Love Train, and so we were doing a video for that song, and in between takes, you stand around, and these kids came up to us, just 15 years old or whatever. They had a boombox, and they said, "Check this out, man! Check this out!" And I went, "What? What do you got there?" They goes, "Our friends used you on a song," and I had no idea what they were talking about. And they played me "Say No Go" on the boombox as I was standing there on the stage. Anyway, push couldn't shove me to understand a path to a basic. Consumers should erase it in a first wave. Cause second wave from believers, and believers will walk to it, then even talk to it and say. Y'all can't have none of that. Tell them what to say, Mace. And I listened to it, and I guess John was standing beside me. And we said, "Wow, that's really cool. I mean, that's really amazing. What a great idea, sampling somebody." That was really new days for things like that.
Now, I want to ask you about one other epic, great reinterpretation of that song. And I wonder how you felt the first time you heard Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, the monstrous, epical hit that I think it's fair to say features a reinterpretation of the very important bass line of that song.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, when we did the We Are the World session, there was a lot of sort of casual conversation between the musicians that were in the room, and Michael came over to me, and he doesn't talk much to anybody, but he decided he was going to start having a conversation with me, and we were talking, and he said, "I hope you don't mind, man. I took, I stole Billie Jean from you. You okay with that?" And I said, "Well, sure, of course, Michael. What do I care? What you did was great." So that's from Michael's mouth.
It's kind of an amazing thing. And what I like about it is that, there's no denying Michael Jackson bringing his full Michael Jackson-ness to his record. And there's no denying that you guys bringing your full Hall & Oates-ness to your record. And they're very different songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, there's no foul there, man. That's completely acceptable.
More with Daryl Hall after a break. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Daryl Hall, the songwriter, frequent songwriter and lead singer of the duo Hall & Oates, who have had innumerable smash hits. More recently, he's been the star of a web series called Live from Daryl's House, in which he collaborates with musicians both known to him and relatively unknown to him in his, 17th century home?
18th.
18th century home. Daryl, this is sort of an interesting inversion of touring. The idea that you've taken the musician's life of going from town to town and turned it into bringing the world to you?
Well, that was exactly the idea. I've been touring my whole adult life, and I thought, okay, well, I still like touring, but not on the in the intense schedule that I've had over the years, and I wanted to do other things. So I said, let's turn it all upside down. Let's bring the world to me. The internet allows this because it's a new world, and let's instead of artists having an act, let's drop the act, no act at all, and no audience. Instead of having an audience, the audience is a fly on the wall. And so basically turn everything that people usually are expect to see and hear in music, turn it upside down.
Let's hear some music from the show. This is my guest, Daryl Hall, with Sharon Jones of the Dap Kings. They are performing a song called Got a Thing in My Mind from Daryl Hall's web series.
I try. Hey, hey, hey. Cause I got what I got. Cause better for time. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of the many people that you've welcomed into your home is one of one of pop music history's greatest songwriters and singers, Smokey Robinson. And I want to play a little bit of a medley that the two of you did. I think it was a little bit of a stealth medley.
It was.
It starts with your iconic hit, Sarah Smile, and then you sort of ease into Smokey Robinson's iconic hit, Baby Baby.
Where I still love you until the day you leave, and I'll cry. Ooh, baby, baby. Ooh.
So in your in this sort of like retrospective of the year episode of your show, you say that that handlers that you'd spoken to had said, like, Smokey's not going to play Baby Baby, like, he's done playing Baby Baby. And you sort of slid it in. Is that true?
Exactly. That was the weirdest thing, because I was so excited to have Smokey at the house. See, I'm like all the kids that come to my house. I'm the veteran, and the kids are the newcomers. Well, Smokey, you listen to that Girl, I Love You song, you know, the first record I ever cut. I'm trying to be Smokey, man. There's no bones about it. And he is such an iconic figure to me. Now, I was lucky enough to have known him over the years, but I've never worked with him in that kind of capacity. So when I heard, you know, in the talking of the, as you said, talking with the handlers, well, Smokey doesn't really want to sing a Baby Baby. I said, what? This is like one of his best songs. And he doesn't really want to sing it. And who knew why? And I sat with T-Bone. I said, Smokey doesn't want to sing a Baby Baby. And we said, you know what? We're just going to make this happen. And if you watch that episode, that bit, you'll see how T-Bone and I drew it out of him. And it's really an interesting thing. And we got him to do it, man.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for being on The Sound of Young America. It was really fun to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Daryl Hall is one half of the duo Hall & Oates and the man behind dozens of hit records. He's also the host of Live from Daryl's House, a web series in which he invites musicians as diverse as Todd Rundgren and Sharon Jones and Toots from Toots and the Maytals to collaborate with him musically and check out his cool house and make and eat some food. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our music is provided to us by Dan Wally. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our editor, Nick White. You can find all of our programs online for free at MaximumFun.org, including our comedy talk show, Jordan, Jesse, Go, in addition to The Sound of Young America, and lots of other cool stuff. If you have thoughts about the show, or you want to bring us out to perform at your local cabaret venue, I don't know why we would perform at a cabaret venue. Anyway, the moral of the story is you can email me at jesse@MaximumFun.org. Otherwise, we'll see you right here, same bat time, same bat channel. Bye-bye. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask MetaFilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.